I'm Natasha Madison. I have the honour of subbing for the wonderful Carol Goss tonight for the Christmas Carol show. And my guest is my longtime friend, who I'm so thrilled to do this today, Steve Sigmund, whom I know first got to meet in 1992 when he was lead trombone for Ray Charles. So we're going to be talking about his life and some of his stories tonight and try and fit his music in. And welcome, Steve.
Well, thank you very much, Natasha. I'm really happy to be here and be happy to have yet another wonderful conversation with you, as we've had many during our years.
Yes, we have. We might touch on the fact we did 15 hours from Miami to North Carolina not so long ago, and my job was to keep you awake while you were driving.
And you did a fabulous job of it.
And I told my life stories, but tonight it's all about you, or in the main, all about you. Should we start with your first song, and then I'm going to get you to talk a little bit about where you grew up and how you came to the trombone.
That sounds excellent.
Okay, so I'm going to do that. Your first song is Mercy, 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 Cannonball Adderley. Here we go.
Thank you.
Cannonball Adderley, Mercy, Mercy, Mercy. Steve, that's your first choice.
That was my first choice. It was not necessarily so important, the version of the song, which this happened to be a live version of Cannonball, who wrote the composition, and his brother Nat recorded in 1966, I believe, in San Francisco. It was the song that was more important to me than the version. When I was entering middle school and first beginning to play the trombone, which came about because when I was in the fifth grade at elementary school, before transitioning to middle school, the band director from the middle school came to our elementary school to see if there were kids that had an interest in learning to play an instrument when they got to middle school.
This was a bit new to you, wasn't it? You didn't come from a strictly musical family, although there was music a little bit around you.
There was music around me, but I did not come from a musical family. Neither of my parents had a musical background, but there was music in the house.
Yeah.
My mother would have the radio on all day during the day as she was taking care of the house and of me, and would have music playing on the radio all day. And my father had a small record collection that included things like Nat King Cole and Bing Crosby and Trini Lopez, and a single record which would become a little more significant in my life later, of Ray Charles.
Yeah, just the one for now.
And
so there you were in school, and they said, would you like to learn an instrument? Is that kind of more or less how it went down? And, yeah.
Initially, I was interested in the trumpet.
Yeah.
But a strange turn of events, I had my childhood friend that I had been acquainted with since kindergarten was going to play the trombone because his family owned one, because his brother had played the trombone a little bit.
Lovely.
And so when I discovered that the trombones and the trumpets sat in different areas of the orchestra, and that meant I couldn't sit next to my childhood friend, ironically, I decided at that point that I wanted to play the trombone. So my career as a trombonist was decided by the social fact of wanting to sit next to my childhood friend who was already playing the trombone.
It is almost as spurious as our good, lovely boss man, as I like to call him, Mr. Maceo Parker, because, you know, his story about starting on saxophone, because he had learned piano and then kind of dropped out because they were all girls. He was the only boy, 8 years old, the only boy. I don't want to be with all these girls. But his mum took him to a parade, or there was a parade coming through town, and he was standing with his mum, and the saxophones were going by, and he said, okay, where's the piano? And she said, you don't know how pianos in parades. And he said, okay, I'll play one of those, just as the saxophones were going by. And we always think, like, it could have been anything going by at that point, you know. And we would have lost, like, we would never have had maybe, you know, one of the world's greatest saxophonists. So I love that you have a parallel kind of story, not quite as random, actually, but that it's all about friendship and loyalty, and here you are
right
tromboning.
And that song is significant to me because when I got to junior high school, in addition to playing in the orchestra, I was asked if I wanted to play in a small jazz group. And this was something that I was completely unfamiliar with. Jazz was a genre that I had not yet been introduced to, and I wanted to play in the small group, not even knowing what jazz was. And this was one of the first songs that we were taught in this little jazz group by this wonderful band director named Gary Frederick in Santa Cruz, California. And so that's what makes this song significant to me.
Yes, and a good point to start. So you grew up pretty much in Santa Cruz, didn't you? Apart from, yeah. I think you were born just outside Santa Cruz.
I was born in the capital of California, which is Sacramento, California.
Of course, yes.
And we lived briefly in a small town south of Sacramento called Chico, California before. And, you know, my parents moved around. My father was a chef, and they moved around as my father changed restaurants periodically. So when I was approximately 4 years old, we landed in Santa Cruz, and that was where we ended up staying and where I grew up.
Great.
Not a bad place to grow up.
No, true. Not a bad place to grow up at all. To be surrounded by the beauty of the landscape and the wonderful people and the arts and culture that were going on in Santa Cruz at that time, it was an excellent place to grow up.
It always seemed like quite a small place, which I loved. You know, we regularly play there at different, with Maceo at different times, and I always found it small and friendly. You know, it just felt like this kind of place that was, you know, not as big as it actually is, I think.
It's true. It's smaller than you think it is, but it has for a small town, it's produced an amazing amount of professional musicians that are still to this day very prominent in the music business. I had Ray Charles actually ask me one time. I was one of a total of, let's see, I guess I was one of a total of five people from this small town that eventually all played with Ray Charles.
That's amazing. That really is amazing.
He asked me one time, what's going on in that town?
Did you ever play there with him?
Yes, one time. There was, because it was not generally a town large enough,
yes,
to support acts as large as Ray Charles. But actually, one time before the end of Ray's career, actually, there was a blues festival in Santa Cruz, which was gaining some prominence. And we played this blues festival, I want to say, in somewhere around 2001, somewhere around that time period, which was the only time that we actually played in Santa Cruz. We played south of Santa Cruz at the world famous Monterey Jazz Festival several times. And we also played north of Santa Cruz, of course, into the San Francisco Bay Area.
Yeah. But tell me, What did you play outdoors for the Blue Festival?
Yes, we did play outdoors.
Because I can't think of anywhere large enough either.
We might
be getting too nerdy for everyone else as we do. You remember this venue? You know,
right.
Now your next choice of music, your next piece is a Count Basie piece. I grew up really listening to Basie. He was one of the people my dad played nonstop. So, you know, any chance I'm like, yay! So would you tell us a bit about this choice? The track is Wind Machine, is that right?
Yes.
Correct there?
This track is from an album called a live album that was recorded at the Montreux Jazz Festival in, I believe, 1979.
I want to interject there, it probably was actually a legal thing. Montreux was so known, I can say this, I think, for like the famous promoter there for recording everyone, and then these albums would come out like in Japan, so you wouldn't know that they'd been released.
Right. I think this was more above board because this album was produced on Norman Grand's Pablo label.
Yes.
But I'm familiar with the things that you reference.
Whereof I speak, yes.
and that will, one of those will come up later in my list. But this album, when I reached high school and first began playing in a big band, in a jazz ensemble, our music teacher, who is still with us and is one of my just most incredible mentors, who I still have contact with. He at lunchtime, he used to leave the band room open, and he used to leave the room that had the stereo in it and the record player open during lunchtime, and we were allowed to play records from his record collection. And I remember specifically, this was the first time that I had heard the Count Basie Orchestra, and we played this record over and over again.
Oh.
I was enchanted by how this band played, and I wanted to play in a band like this. And so this track is the opening track from that album and was my introduction to big band music.
Fantastic. Here we go. We'll be right back. all going on. They're lovely. Yeah, I can see how that, Steve, would make you think, how can I go and do that?
Exactly. That was exactly my thought, was how could I go and do that? I was very fortunate later to have gotten to see Count Basie several times live before he passed away, and also have since become acquainted with several of the musicians that actually played on that record. And so that kind of launched my love of big band music.
Fantastic. So you went off. You're going through high school. You pretty much self-taught, you told me. You self-taught yourself trombone, which already seems like a fantastic feat.
Yeah, my parents were not able to afford any sort of private music lessons for me. So what I learned, I strictly learned just both at school as part of an ensemble, and then self-taught, kind of figuring things out on my own.
Was there a trombone teacher in your school?
No, there was not.
So you're basically there just figuring it all out, working out how the trombone works, how that slide thing works.
Yeah.
Figuring notes, everything.
We were given a method book distinct to our instrument, depending on what instrument you played. You were given a method book to read and work out of, but there was just a single band director who was responsible for everyone in the band or orchestra. And so there was no individualized instruction at that point. And so, no, I just had to kind of figure it out on my own.
And they do say, I read a really interesting article once about a study that was done with people who don't even have music necessarily as their first subject. So people who are scientists, say, or studying medicine in particular, but who had music as their second subject, and all those people did far better in terms of what they were doing as science in their main topic if they had music as their not as a major, as a second subject. It's possibly, I think, I was told something to do with learning to work things out for yourself, which seems a fantastic way that we should all be educated. But you really, really had to do that in terms of being a musician.
It's first of all, it's funny that you mentioned that, because later in my life, I would need to have a back surgery for a ruptured disc, and the neurosurgeon who performed my back surgery, one of the reasons why I chose him, in addition to his great reputation as a surgeon, was secondary love that I wouldn't classify as a hobby, because it was much more than that to him, was being a concert pianist.
Wow. Which is classical.
Yeah, concert pianist. And so when I heard that, I knew that was the doctor I wanted, because, as you mentioned, music is both very scientific, and it's also mathematical also. Music is math. Music is all about numbers. And music is all about division and fractions and all of that. So, yes, there are people,
there are conversations I've had with completely non-musical, by which I mean, you know, I don't play an instrument, but I have been immersed in a musical world and environment for most of my working life. But there are people that have none of that. So they just know they like this music, you know, and they like music and they like listening and probably dancing or something. I've had one or two conversations where people are mortally offended when I say, no, it's not just this free thing. It's got quite a serious structure. And it's within the structure and the discipline that this beauty comes out. But yes, it's very mathematical.
You know, many of the great musicians that played, you know, Ornette Coleman being one, saxophonist Ornette Coleman being one of them, who were prominent in this area of jazz that for a while, especially in the 60s and early 70s, they called free jazz.
Yes.
Ornette Coleman would often say that, people would classify free jazz using terms called playing music out or outside of the norm.
Yes.
And Ornette Coleman was a very learned musician who was a pioneer in this area, but he would often remind people that you can't play out, so to speak, you can't play out until you know how to play in.
Yes. I heard Abby Lincoln, the fabulous Abby Lincoln, one of my favorite jazz singers, one of my favorite singers, actually, who I had the honor to meet way back when, and she was talking about a particular musician who she felt had gone too far out, and she said pretty much exactly what you said, word for word. You know, he's forgotten that in order to go out, you have to be in the first place.
Exactly. And the most prominent people, whether it's Ornette Coleman, trumpeter Don Cherry, many, many folks who were classified in that realm, were all extremely learned musicians. Who just were trying to take the music on a different path.
Yes.
And so, yes, I understand that path was not always pleasing to everyone's ears, but it didn't mean that.
And so, yes, folks, I understand.
Were not
that
extremely
path
musicians.
Was not always.
I believe we've been joined by somebody on the phone here. Let me just see if that's somebody familiar. No, it's not. I would ask that you turn the stream off in the background.
Just
there
done,
we go. Austin.
So, yeah, sorry about that.
Not a problem.
I should know better.
Oh, my God. So, I know that voice.
Who could it be? Who could it be?
Is it my favorite jokey trombone player?
It's the voice. It's the voice of a person who changed my life.
Oh, fantastic! I was hoping he'd come on about this point. This is perfect.
I was just trying to get him to change his socks, but you know,
there you go.
A little bit.
So we're listening. We are joined by the wonderful Dan Marcus. Hailing from Seattle. Are you in Seattle right now?
Correct. Yes. Lovely, beautiful, sunny, warm, balmy Seattle, where it's 34
also
degrees.
One of the Ray Charles alumni. And Steve, will you tell us a little bit about how this man changed your life?
Well, I approximately give or take, approximately 1983. I was trying to find my way as a trombone player, and as I mentioned to you previously, I had never had any formal trombone lessons,
if you count me.
I was very fortunate that a great mutual friend of ours who I went to high school with, who I still have contact with to this day, a amazing drummer named Jeff Ballard, introduced me to Dan. And
Dan, where do you hail from? Do you hail from Santa Cruz area too?
I was living in Santa Cruz at that point. I'm from the Bay Area, from the San Francisco Bay Area, but I had moved to Santa Cruz initially for college back when dinosaurs roamed the earth, and then I moved back after I got off the road in 83. Settled down
and,
for a while.
And I asked Dan if he would give me trombone lessons. And in spite of his better judgment, he agreed.
I'll tell you exactly how that conversation went, since he's soft pedaling it. This kid walks up to me, about 18, and he goes, "Hi, I'm Steve." And I said, "Hi." He says, I want to study with you and learn to do everything that you do, and then I want to go out with Ray Charles like you did. And
okay. But that didn't all happen in the initial conversation.
I remember it. It was in front of Positively Run Front Street, right over by the Dream Inn. I don't know what we were doing there, but
Front Street. Wow. I didn't think I asked you about going on the road with Ray until I got to your house.
Oh, okay.
It's
probably true. There might have been a 5-7 minute lag time there at something like that.
So that ended up trombone lessons. Let's see.
Steve sort of became, I didn't feel right about charging him, so he sort of became my aide-de-camp for a while.
Does that mean he had to carry your trombone around for you?
No,
I wouldn't. No, it was much worse than that.
All right. Shortly afterwards, so Dan was, at that time, though, initially, you were driving the Volkswagen, or no, you were driving the Volvo.
That's right.
And you
65.
Were living. You were living in a very small place.
Yep.
I don't remember that street.
Broadway. I was on Broadway itself.
Okay. Come on, guys. We're going to get to the chase, though.
Yeah. Okay. So.
All right. Yeah. So. Yeah.
So speed up. Trombone lessons. Dan buys a house, and I end up trading trombone lessons for working on the house.
Fantastic.
Sweat equity.
Sweat equity. Yes.
Some good pictures from back then. Good times. And
yes.
And
yes.
Yeah. And he got to be a really formidable trombonist. You know. No thanks to me, but
there's a lot of thanks to Dan, and I'll summarize by Dan briefly in the fall of 84 went back out on the road with Ray Charles, and came back, and I was more pestering him than ever about how I could get on this gig.
Yeah.
Sure.
So this is it. Up to this point, you've been kind of doing Local gigs.
Yeah, I've been doing local gigs and gigs that Dan would send me on. And
wow, that's quite a leap from local gigs to on the road with Ray Charles. Wow.
Isn't it just, and I love that you didn't like go, I should do this in stages. This is like dreaming big. I'm going from this to Ray Charles. You know, it's
well, I you know, for the purposes of time, I'm skipping a little bit of the time that
that's all right.
At some point in 1985, I recorded a demo tape to send to Ray Charles, musical director, and never heard anything back from that. But fast forward, we get to the end of 1986, and my phone rings one day, and all of a sudden, I was getting offered to go with Dan to Florida to play Christmas and New Year's with Ray Charles. And
who phoned you?
Well, the person on the other end of the phone was, hi, is this Steve Sigman? Yes. Hi, this is Brother Ray.
Love it.
Because in those days, he still called musicians himself. He would be recommended someone by his musical director or by somebody in the band, and he would still call musicians himself. And
that's fantastic.
I have to interrupt for just one second because he's passing over the best part about the demo tape.
Okay.
So Steve used three local musicians. I guess we could name them. You know, Jeff Ballard,
yeah, sure.
Kenny Carr.
Kenny Carr.
And was it
Jeff Ballard?
Yeah. Was it Nils?
No, it was Anders, actually.
Oh, Anders Swanson. That's right. So Steve sends in the demo tape, and one by one, the other three guys all get hired to play with Ray.
Oh no! Yeah.
and actually, the person who got hired first off that demo tape was not me.
Right.
The person that got hired off that demo tape first was the guitarist, Kenny Carr. Kenny got hired in the fall of 1986. When the current guitar player at the time, Jeff Pivar, left the band. And so Kenny got hired from my demo tape before I got hired.
Were you slightly offended? Like,
no.
Yeah, I thought this was about me. Or were you like, yay?
No, I wasn't, because I was happy for Kenny. And I also knew, I was probably a little disappointed at the time, but I knew that somebody had actually listened to my tape.
That's right.
So that was, and then the call for me came about 2 months later, you know?
Right.
And I went with Dan down to Florida, and we played Christmas and New Year's of 1986.
I'd forgotten all about that.
Yeah. That was at the Diplomat Hotel in Hollandale, Florida. We played Christmas and New Year's. And then I expressed a desire to stay on the band. And I got called back later on in spring to join my first full tour in 1987.
Where did you go on that tour? Were you outside the U.S.?
Yes, in those days we were touring approximately 7 months out of the year. We would.
Yeah, I know those kind of days. Yeah.
So that
tour took you out into Europe or everywhere?
Took me to Europe twice that year.
And was that your first time out of the States?
It was my first time. It was only my second time. No, it was only my third time out of California.
My goodness gracious.
I had to do things like I had to go to I had to go to San Francisco to get a passport.
Passport, yeah.
And
but you must have been. Were you just excited about all of it? I mean,
I was excited about all of it. I was excited, but I also remember the first couple of weeks. I was scared to death. I was the trombone player out of four trombone players. I was the third trombone player, and I was genuinely scared to death that I was going to get fired every night.
And Dan, were you in the band too at that point?
No. I came back out briefly in '88, but at that point I had gone on to a day gig thing and was playing around. Bought the house and was playing around Santa Cruz.
Mm-hmm.
No, San Jose, San Francisco.
I was around. You know, I was one of the probably, I think, one of the two youngest guys. I think Kenny Carr and I were the youngest guys in the band.
And you couldn't even sit next to him because he wasn't playing trombone.
No. And I didn't know any of these people.
Mm.
Most of these people were road veterans.
Mm.
Yep.
And I was genuinely... While I was excited and happy because I was doing what I loved and what I wanted to do for the first few weeks, I thought, oh, I'm not, you know, they're not going to like my playing. I'm going to, you know, I was scared to death. I was going to get fired every night.
So basically, if I can ask this in the right way. Well, you know, if you were in James Brown's band, you got fined, and I don't know if he fired people or how he fired people, but he did fire people, but not that much. But would you get fired pretty much if they thought you weren't up to the gig, that you weren't? Oh, I mean, was it simply your nerves that made you scared?
No, Dan was... Dan is right. It's pretty rare. I literally in the long length of time that I did the gig, I saw only a couple of people get fired for cause, so to speak, for musical cause.
Yeah.
I only saw a couple of people get fired for musical cause. No, this was all my own insecurity.
Okay. Fair enough, because you're what, 18, 19? How old are you now?
I was 22.
It's young, you know.
Yeah.
I told one of my nephews the other week, I'm not considering anyone an adult till they're 40. So, you know.
Yeah.
but seriously, it's young and it's, and all new. Everything's new. If you've only been couple of times out of California.
But I was also very fortunate that I was befriended in a great way by many of the folks that were there on that first band that I was on. And I knew, and Dan probably doesn't even remember some of the advice that he gave me, in that initial trip, in which Dan encouraged me to listen to these older folks. People like the band leader Clifford Solomon, and who was the person who hired me, and keyboardist Ernest Van Treese, who became my long, very close friend. You know, saxophonist Rudy Johnson, and that was one of the rare points in my life in which also I actually listened to Dan when he told me to be quiet and listen.
I'm going to move on to the next song, if I may. But so we try and get through your list. That's not meant to sound like a chore. It's just so easy once you get talking to forget there's music to be played too. Your next choice, Carl Fontana, Shouting on a Riff. Do you want to give a quick intro to that?
Yeah.
Good choice.
As I was studying with Dan and listening to a variety of things that I had never listened to before, I became musically acquainted with the great trombonist Carl Fontana, and I heard things done with the trombone that I had never heard before, and I heard a style and a sound that that I really wanted to hear more about and know more about, and I wanted to try I wanted to try and mess around and see if there was any small amount of this amazing trombone player's playing that I could incorporate into my playing. So I became a great fan of the great Carl Fontana, and I picked this track. This is an album that he recorded with saxophonist Al Cohn, and there's not a lot of recorded output from Carl in his life, and so this was one of his few solo albums.
Okay, we're going to listen to it. And Dan, please stay with us. We're going to ask you to mute your phone while the music's playing, but please stay with us if you can. Here we go. Very good. We'll be right back. Fantastic.
Yeah, that's a great track.
Really great track.
Really sounded so good. Carl.
Yeah.
I'll do a brief anecdote. I was on my first year on the road, and we were playing Vegas, and John Boyce. Was John still out when you went out, Face?
I did. John came back. John did one tour with us at one point.
So John Boyce had lived in Vegas, and he took me to this club. He said, I want you to hear somebody. And so he walks me to this club. I think it's called the Four Queens. And there's this little trio quartet playing, a trombone player. And I go, who is that? He goes, that's Carl Fontana. I went, oh, I think I've heard of him. And, I'm like 20. And so John introduces me, and Carl says, hey, nice to meet you. Did you bring your axe? And I went, no. He says, oh, well, you can play mine. And so we kicked off some tune at light speed, and he got finished with his chorus and handed me his horn, mouthpiece and all. It was back in those
days,
and we didn't worry about cooties. That was very cool.
Because 9 times out of 10 that I've ever seen people tune, especially horns, people aren't that generous at all, are they? How fantastic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have a similar Las Vegas Carl Fontana story, although I didn't sit in. We were playing at Caesar's Palace for 2 weeks, and down the street was, off the strip, was a small local casino called Bourbon Street. And from 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. in the morning was the Carl Fontana Jazz Quartet that played every night from 1 to 5 in the morning. Mm. So
It's 2 o'clock in the morning for me here, but I'm, Dave and I were talking about this the other day, kind of privately, while I was trying to hone my skills a little bit. My whole sort of idea of what we're doing right now is, we've done the gig, we're doing an overnighter in a tour bus, we've all tumbled into the tour bus, and we're just telling stories back and forth, listening to music, maybe with a glass of wine in hand before we conk out in the early hours. So yeah.
Yep.
So exactly. Already it's feeling like this. We've got a nice little thing going in our virtual tour bus.
So we used to finish.
We've got Dan to tell the jokes, because that is what I remember about being on the road with Dan. Always a joke to hand. Steve, I want to move to your next song, because I do. I want to try and fit them all in if I can. And your next song is a Fred Wesley song. Fred's the person through whom I got to hear trombone, if you know what I mean, and I'm sure you do.
Fred.
So I hadn't really paid any attention to trombone, not properly at all, not really, whatever, until I met Fred and started working with Maceo. And suddenly I was like, oh, wow, now I get it. Tell me about your relationship with Fred, who also did a stint in the Ray Charles Orchestra.
He did before either Dan or I played with Ray. Yeah. Fred did a short stint in the 70s with Ray. Fred was a close friend of Ray's musical director, Clifford Solomon. They had played together. They played together in Los Angeles. They'd also toured together with the Ike and Tina Turner Review. And right. So, but I first became acquainted with Fred's playing from the album that this track is from. This is from an album that was produced by James Brown called Damn Right I Am Somebody.
These titles, they're very Fred. The actual track that we're going to listen to, almost all of these songs, like, you know, the line from the Watergate one. What is something something Watergate? Just give me my bucks and I'll be straight.
Yeah,
I don't want your Watergate. Just give me
my bucks and I'll be straight.
I'll
be straight. Natasha, tell me your most famous Fred line that you have also used in the past.
If we're talking about gee golly doesn't get it, sometimes gee golly doesn't get it.
No. The other famous one, which is, you don't know who I think I am.
Oh, yes.
You don't know who I think I am.
Yeah. So, that's true. There's so many. I told Fred, when he, I think before he embarked on his autobiography, I told him, Fred, can't we just do a book of Fred's aphorisms, you know, quotes from Fred, because he could have you in stitches. Fred had a way of telling a joke, too, that I think even would outdo you, Dan Marcus.
Well, I learned from Fred Wesley.
This album,
he's the model.
This album was produced by James Brown.
Can I just say something about that? I don't think I'm giving away any kind of secrets, but nearly everything. In there was this period, you know, where James gave out, you know, he had these side projects. So Lynn Collins would do an album, Mace would do an album, Fred would do an album, Sweet Charles Sherrell would do an album, and so on. Marva Whitney would do an album. And they're always produced by James Brown. That was his thing on it. And what I do know from hearing from both Fred and Mace is most of the time Fred was producing it, obviously. Right. You probably know that. But James always had to put his mark on it, you know, and that was his way.
We had another producer term for that, but we won't say it on radio. We say it about RC, too. Something about sticking something. Yes.
Yeah, that's true. Maceo is on this album and is called out by Fred on several tracks, not on this particular track, but Fred calls him out on several tracks. But I bought this album at a place that was actually very famous in the San Francisco Bay Area in Santa Cruz, called Logos Books and Records.
Oh yeah.
And had the most amazing used record department, and I bought this record and I'd never heard the trombone like this in life. And
you do know that one of the first bands Fred was in, or I don't know if it was, no, it can't have been one of the first bands, but yeah, maybe it was. So somewhere in the early to mid 60s, whatever band he joined, they just said, we want you to play trombone like Maceo Parker played saxophone for James Brown.
There you go.
And you can see based on that, that from that point, they were always going to sound great together.
There is, and I said this to Fred recently, that there will never be a trombonist and alto saxophonist together that made more great music than Fred Wesley and Maceo Parker.
Yeah. On their own, they could sound like a whole horn section.
The title of this track is, If You Don't Get It the First Time, Back Up and Try Again.
Okay, here we go.
Fellas, can we still do it?
Yeah!
How can we do it?
Do it today!
How can we do it?
Do it today!
Right now! Yes, indeed!
Red Wesley and the JBs, if you don't get it the first time, back up and try it again. Quite a mouthful, that title.
Yes.
So, we...
All about the funk.
When did you first meet Fred, Steve?
You know, I think I actually met and spoke to Fred the first time. I want to say there was, might be somewhere around 88. He went back for a very short time, and I don't even, it may even have just been just a matter of a few gigs, but he went back with James for a very short time.
Yeah, I think Mace went back in 88. He may have gone back either around the same time or just before.
Yeah. I saw them at the North Sea Jazz Festival in Holland.
Right.
I met him just briefly then. Wouldn't say I really talked to him very much. I actually became much more friendly with him when I first met you in 1992. And then when we were on the road together in Europe, and I got to spend a lot more time with Fred and became acquainted with Fred and have since...
And that's really funny to me, because my impression from that time was that you already knew each other quite well.
Yeah, no, we didn't. No, not that well.
Because you were the one person in the band, of course, who I got to know. This is really says more about you in that time. And it was so, for people listening, 1992, JBC Super Sessions was a double session thing that George Ween's office from New York Festival Productions would put on, would pair up two people, one as a headliner and one as the second person, the opening act, if you like. So a little under the big headliner, and they do it. And it was called JBC Super Sessions. And it was always kind of jazzy based, although more open than, you know, strict jazz in a box. And that, that came to us because Dan Melnick, who worked for Festival Productions, contacted me and said, Natasha, what do you think about doing a tour in the summer opening for, I think it, no, it wasn't in the summer, was it? It was the fall, I think.
Yeah.
In the fall, opening Ray Charles. And I said, yes. And he said, no, you have to go away and talk to Maceo. And I said, I know what the answer's going to be, Dan. It's going to be yes. And he said, no, you must go away and talk to Maceo. So I called Mace.
Hell yeah.
And I said, what do you think about opening, doing? He said, why are you actually calling me? He probably didn't, you know, he's like, what? Did you say yes? I said yes, but they wanted me to check with you. I know what the answer is, yes. I mean, this is like Maceo's musical hero, Ray Charles, and we have a chance to open. Are you kidding me? So that's really how it happened.
I immediately gravitated to Fred because by that time I had been listening to a lot of Fred, including some of Fred's jazz records. And so that's great. Okay, we're doing this tour with Maceo and his band, featuring Maceo, Fred, and Pee Wee. And I want to get to talk to Fred. And
yes.
So I knew immediately that I was going to talk to Fred. And
we got the gig because Maceo and I were known as being easy people to deal with. And I don't mean pushovers. So there was another person cited to be on the bill, and Dan said, listen, you know, we've got Ray, we've got his manager, that can be tricky sometimes. We're going to, you know, we really want you and Maceo because we really love you guys, and we know it's kind of, you're really straightforward to deal with, and we kind of need that. And so that's what happened, really. You know, it was really validating because this was in my very early years of working with Mace, and, you know, that I had a good reputation, which I have to give all credit to Mace for. But, you know, it's very validating when that happens. So there we are on the road, and I get to know you, because by the time we're playing London, which is the Hammersmith Odeon, as it was then, you arrange that I can have a photo with Ray Charles.
And your mom.
No, my mom wasn't in the photo. My mom came to that show. You were in the room when my mom went.
She wasn't in the photo. She came to the show. Yeah, right.
Yeah, she came to the show, and you said, do you want, would your mom like to meet Ray? And I'm like, yeah, of course, I'm sure she would. And my brother, who was there, was like, can I go? I'm like, no, you're not invited, nor am I. And you took her in, and she was very shy and didn't say anything. Is that right? Is that what happened?
I can remember that. The funniest thing about the picture, though, the picture of you and Ray, which Dan will appreciate, I got them in the dressing room. And
no, it's coming out. He was coming out of the dressing room.
But immediately in the background of that picture is Ray's personal manager, Joe Adams.
With his arms crossed.
No.
Yeah, with his arms crossed. Looking not very happy about the whole situation.
Yeah, and there's Maceo next to him making a funny face, which is good. I love that picture. It tells such stories.
It does.
Really does. On its own without our backup stories.
I was very appreciative of getting to know Fred and have been I've been really honored to maintain contact with Fred over the years, and I know how close he is to Maceo and what they mean to each other, and as friends and musicians, and it's been my pleasure to know them both.
Great. I'm going to move to your next song. And would you tell us a little bit about it, please?
Yes, because this has a connection to Dan Marcus. At some point during my early relationship with Dan, Dan was nice enough to send me on gigs once in a while to sub for him. And he sent me to a Latin club in San Jose to sub for him on a Latin gig, which was the first time I had played in a Latin band before. And what's that?
The Test of Fire.
Yes, exactly. And Dan gave me explicit instructions for how I was going to collect my money at the end of this experience.
or not.
Yeah, some other things that it's better not to go into on the radio. But anyway, from a musical standpoint, I was very enamored with this music. With Latin music, specifically salsa music, and its use of the trombone and its history of the trombone. And I began to listen to this music, and especially the early music where the trombone was very prominent. And this is from a very famous album from the 1970s. The artists are Willie Colon and Reuben Blades. And the horn section of this album is a total of four trombones, three trombones.
Oh, libre.
Yeah, three trombones in the section, and Willie Colon also periodically playing trombone. And I had never heard the trombone like before. And this also changed a lot of my musical thinking about the trombone. And,
fantastic. Yeah. I'm going to go to it, Steve. Here we go.
Hay ojos de miles miradas, cristales que observan al mundo pasar. Ojos que encuentran fortuna mirando a la luna y a su resplandor. Hay ojos que emanan ternura y hay ojos de inmenso dolor. Ojos que en noches oscuras viven de amarguras y desolación. Pero hay ojos que saben reír, hay ojos de eterno fulgor, ojos que ven en las flores de multicolores la gracia de Dios.
Ojos
de jóvenes y viejos,
ojos
en todos los...
fantastic. A piece of music I don't know at all. I love learning new, discovering new things. Thank you for that.
Was that Libre, Steve? Conjunto Libre?
No, that was Ojos.
Ojos.
Which is eyes in Spanish.
Yes, correct. Cool. Correct. That was from a very famous album called Siembra, Willie Colon and Ruben Blades. The trombonists were Reynaldo Jorge, Papo Vasquez, Louis Kahn, and, of course, Willie Colon.
There you go. And, of course, Papo was out with Ray, too.
Yes, Papo Vasquez, also an alumnus of Ray Charles.
Yes, that was an interesting year.
Yeah, you were there for that, right?
It was Arturo Velasco, Papo Vasquez, Mayo Tiana, and the white guy. So they would rap in Spanish on the bandstand. I was just like, what? But we did go to see Conjunto Libre together one time in New York.
Right.
We got to see the King, right. four bone band.
Yep. Right, right.
Yeah, right on.
Yeah, that's I had at that point. I had never heard the trombone like that before, and I became very enamored with that music, and have since always loved to listen to it and play it. And it's one of those things that the trombone was very prominent in.
Call them brain damage gigs.
Yes, right. Yes, Natasha.
I'm wondering if we can go straight to your next track, because I want to try and fit all our songs in, and we have too much fun chatting.
Do you want to skip six and go to seven?
We could do that. Yes, let's go to, yeah, we'll bear with me. Let's go to seven.
Okay.
Because this one needs... Almost no introduction.
It's going to get a small introduction, but it needs no introduction in general. What I'm going to say about this tune is two things. First of all, Natasha, this is what you referenced in Claude Knobs recording a show and we only finding out later that this actually happened. Before it became an album. And the second thing is I estimated in the time I spent with Ray that probably I played this song in the neighborhood of 2,000 times. But if you really understood musically where Ray was coming from and you listened to him play this song every night, he would do a little something different to it every night, which made it unique and just, you know, continued to make him amazing.
Okay, we're going to it.
I sing this song, I sing for Georgia. This whole sweet song keeps Georgia on my mind. Oh, Georgia. Oh, my Georgia.
Really fantastic version, Steve. Really.
That was recorded July of 1997 at the Montreux Jazz Festival. And I would dedicate that track to my Dan and I's longtime friend and bandmate and all-around good guy, Peter Turry, who just left us recently too soon.
Much too soon, and there was a gorgeous shot of him right at the end of the video there. Because of course I'm watching the YouTube video. on screen. There's a fantastic, the closing shot is of Peter. So and lovely to see his useful face there.
It is, I'll just briefly say, we, of course, we had no idea that, well, we knew that we were shooting a TV show that night. We knew we were shooting a TV show, but we had no idea that we were recording what would end up becoming an album. It was the middle of a very arduous European tour. We got to Montreux late in the day, had as a familiar story to Natasha, had literally minutes in the hotel before having to go to the venue after traveling from who knows where. And it was the band and Ray and the ladies were in amazing form, as we normally, you know, from a musical's perspective, a lot of times the greater the traveling adversity, the better the band sounded.
Wow.
Yeah. Often the case. Magic of the stage is what Fred Wesley used to call it. Can be super ill, put your foot on the stage, and everything transforms.
Yep, that's 100%. And it was certainly like that night. There was and we were very, in a way, we ended up being very fortunate that got made into an album that we normally, as Ray's band, we spent most of our time to the public in anonymity. Our names didn't go on record albums. Our names didn't go attached to TV shows or.
Okay, so they put your names on, but actually, in the normal course of events, musicians should be paid for albums that they appear on.
This was one of the rare instances where our names actually appeared on the album with Ray, and it was musically a great night, and we were fortunate that was
You see, I'm torn. I totally get it, but I have this thing, especially for somebody in the position that Claude Nobbs was in. I will name him for years and years and years of a decade. You know, running this very exclusive festival in Montreux, you know, for which people got paid, yes, very handsomely, but. You know, just and apparently his house was wall to wall of the tapes of everybody he'd recorded. And there's something for me, because of the way I worked in the business, fundamentally wrong about that. And I just had a bit of a Facebook argument with somebody who may even be listening in, who does a James Brown and Friends page, which is beautifully put together and everything else, and but features huge amounts of Maceo week by week by week. And the other day, something was up there, the J.B. Horns, five albums. And I said, no, these are illegal. And there wasn't really, a J.B. Horns as an entity. Not really, really. It was a couple of albums that were made legally. And I got a reply back saying, it's not my, take it up with the record company, and it's not me. And I said, but you're promoting this online, you're promoting it. And it's, you know, it's a fight I've been doing for 30 years, and I will continue to fight it, I guess, probably till the end of my days, or as long as I can still fight, which is, you know, everybody needs to be recompensed. You know, and whether you're recording with your phone or whether you're recording, of course, it is a greater thing if you're, you know, the head of Montreux Festival and you're doing side deals with the Japanese to have stuff released there, but so nobody ever sees it elsewhere and doesn't necessarily realize it's going on. But Steve, haven't you been in the record shops, as we still call them, in Japan. And there's like, because I've seen more Ray Charles than anyone else, there's like rows and rows and rows and rows and rows of what we would call bootlegs, but they're all kind of officially done.
Yeah, we used to see that. We used to see that in Italy a lot. We had Ray had a very, very famous, but also very unscrupulous Italian promoter. And we know that we were regularly getting either recorded or there would be cameras that would be discovered that would not.
I've been there, yes, yes.
And so we had this happen to us. We know quite a bit, you know.
Yeah.
And I think, from what I understand, I think that Claude Knobs, in this particular case, you know, like I said, we knew that we were being filmed for a TV show that night. We knew that.
Yeah.
We knew that we were being filmed for TV, but I think that at some point then Claude evidently went to Ray or Ray's people, and they wanted to take the audio and do something with it, and they had a deal with a record label, and so at some point, you know, money must have changed hands.
Yeah, I think for now we'll leave it there, because we're going to do more chats down the line, and it's an ongoing, it's a never-ending conversation. And I want to, I'm looking at the time, as you do when you're on stage.
I would like to do, if we can squeeze it in, I'd like to do 8 and 10.
That's what I figured. And 8, if I'm right, let me just have a look at my little list. 8 is exactly what I have lined up. Can we play it and then you can tell us about it? Should we do it that way around?
Yeah, let's do that. Let's do that.
Okay. Here we go. Don't forget to mute everyone.
I've got you under my skin. I have got you deep in the heart of me. So deep in my heart that you're really a part of me. I've got you under my skin. I tried so not to give in, and I said to myself, this affair, it never will go so well. But why should I try to resist when, baby, I know damn well that I've got you under my skin. I would sacrifice anything, come what might, for the sake of having you near, in spite of a warning voice that comes in the night and repeats, repeats in my ear. Don't you know, you fool, you never can win. Use your mentality, wake up to reality. But each time I do, just the thought of you makes me stop before I begin. 'Cause I've got you under my skin. sacrifice anything, come what might, for the sake of having you near. In spite of a warning voice, it comes in the night and repeats how it yells in my ear. Don't you know, you fool, ain't no chance to win. Why not use your mentality? Get up, wake up to reality. And each time I do, just the thought of you makes me stop before I begin. Because I've got you under my skin, and you grab me under my skin. Thank you very much. This next song is an example of a soundtrack tune from Johnny Mercer.
I almost wanted to hear that next one. Except we don't have time. So tell us about that.
That is Las Vegas-based vocalist Steve Lippia, who I've actually known since I first moved to Florida in 1995. And after Ray Charles passed away in 2004, in 2005, Steve asked me if I would become his musical director and conductor and trombone player and travel with him, which I have been doing since 2005. And that is from an album recorded live at the State Theater in Easton, Pennsylvania in 2009, and an album which I was very proud to have produced, and an album that was also, we were very proud to have it nominated for a Grammy in 2009.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Lovely.
Marvelous vocalist, a singer of standards in the style of Michael Bublé, Frank Sinatra, Harry Connick Jr. It's been a wonderful experience conducting bands and symphony orchestras for Steve.
Which moves us great and beautifully into really the work that we've been able to do together. We started actually talking about it quite a while before and came to fruition in 2016. So can I start off the story and
yes,
then you can butt in? So after Ray Charles passed, Maceo was thinking a lot about the Ray Charles manager. I wonder what happens to those guys. I hope they're all okay and doing okay. Wouldn't it be great if I could go and kind of like front the band sometime? Because as we know, Steve, Maceo's natural singing voice is very close to Ray Charles. And so gradually this idea dawned on me that it would just be such a great thing to do, but I had no idea how we were going to do it. And I always thought, we need to get sponsorship and, you know, keeping a group of 24 plus people on the road is quite a heavy thing. And then one day I was on Facebook and I saw you, my Facebook friend by then, because we kept up now and then. We'd run into each other quite a few times since 1992. Had posted something. Was it Jamie Foxx?
And this actually, I don't. Dan, are you still with us? Okay, I think Dan Marcus has left us. But
no, I'm here. I'm just cooking.
Oh, you're cooking. Okay. So this thing about Jamie Foxx, this kind of, you know, spoof about Jamie Foxx, I think actually was something that Dan had read, and I think I reposted it from Dan, actually.
And to me, it looked like, Jamie Foxx, who, you know, everyone knows it starred as Ray in the movie, Ray, was going to front the Ray Charles Band, and I was like, oh, darn it. And I wrote you a private message, and I went, oh, Steve, this is my dream, was to do this with Mace. Really? I was all disappointed in Qatar. I'm like, you know, Jamie Foxx won't do this as well as Mace, you know, in my head. And you reminded me what day of the year it was.
Yes, I believe it was April Fool's Day.
That is correct. Ding, 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 ding.
And it was such a relief. So you actually are the perfect person to be in this conversation, Dan, also, because kind of this is how it all came about. And then Steve and I just started talking and saying, what did you tell me, Steve? You said, well, Mace is one of the two people or three people that we always felt could kind of front this.
Yeah, it's true. If the people that could have legitimately done this and paid the right tribute to the music, in my mind, was, and several other people that I had talked to amongst our alumni, was always Maceo, and at that time, Billy Preston, who was still with us at that point. And the list was very short of people who we thought could legitimately pay the proper tribute to this music.
And I always thought the only way to be able to do it, just I'm thinking, you know, budgets and things, would be to have special guests come in, you know, and sing a song or two. But we found a way, to cut a long story short, that it could work. And the very first gig we got, thanks to the wonderful Janet Disney and her team at our agents in the States, IMN Music, our first gig was at Hollywood Bowl.
In front of almost 12,000 people at the Hollywood Bowl.
Yeah. And so, yeah.
Nowhere to go but down.
I wish that we had more time to tell this story. I know time is getting short. This certainly led to just a beautiful association between us as Ray Charles alumni and Maceo, and of course Maceo's team, which is Natasha and Andrew Gilchrist, Goat Gilchrist, and
we got on our show last week.
Yes, exactly, and
it's been the most fantastic association, and I'm just gonna kind of quote James Bond and Sean Connery and say never say never. that's my only comment on, you know, looking forward.
I think that's the proper comment, and this leads us forward to my final track, which I had the phenomenal honor and privilege of Natasha bringing me in to be both involved with the production team and also to get to play on three tracks of Maceo's most recent album, which Natasha has talked about before on the show. This is my favorite track from the album because I know how much Maceo loved David Fathead Newman. And this was a tune made famous by David Fathead Newman.
I'm going to say two things before we play the tune, play the song. I had a little message from Eli Wolf today, who was our producer for the album. And last week, he'd been listening to last week's show on archive and said how much he appreciates. It's so proud of this album. I'm going to say it again. I'm going to say it every time we play something from the album, whether, you know, if I'm a guest on Carol's show or if I'm, you know, guest hosting like I am today. I'm so proud of this album. I'm prouder of it than almost any album, I think. I think it's, in that sense, I'm not saying it's the greatest, I'm not saying it's not, but I am most proud of this album. And this track is called Hard Times, which the album was released in the middle of 2020, which is why people didn't get to hear about it as much as they should. And in a way, this track sums up for me the mood of the pandemic, because we were in really hard times. We still are in some ways. But I listened to this the other day as I was listening through your song list, Steve. And it's pure Maceo, really, isn't it? It's really joy, sadness, more joy again. And he just every note is just perfect. So on that note, thank you so much, Steve. In case we run out of time playing the track, using the track to play out, it's been such a pleasure talking, and we have to do it again.
Thank you so much, and I would like to thank and say much love to my lifelong friend Dan Marcus for and talking to
back
us.
Back at you, dude.
And
you know that.
Let's hear Maceo.
Let's go back on the road.
Wow. Right to the minute. Well done, Natasha. That was another great show, and I look forward to future shows. Are you on next week at this time?
If you want me to be, I absolutely can be.
All right.
I second that motion.
It looks like Tim Windisch is gearing up for the last one or both of the last 2 weeks of February. So we have that to look forward to. I don't know what he's got up his sleeve, but he assures me that he's got something big cooking. So it'll be interesting to see what it is. So it is now time at 10 o'clock for No Money Mark's Varieties of Variousness. And I see that No Money Mark is on the line. Take it away, Mark.